All right, so I have no disclosures to report today. And just a brief outline of my presentation, I'm going to review the dimensions of sexual orientation before I talk about women who have sex with women in general. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about the epidemiology of sexually transmitted infections among this group of women. And I mainly want to focus on some data that we have about specific female-to-female sexual transmission of some of our STIs, and also some interesting differences that are emerging in the literature between exclusive women who have sex with women and women who have sex with women and men. And finally, I just want to end with our current National STD Treatment Guideline recommendations for STI testing and prevention in this group of women. And so just to review the dimensions of sexual orientation, there's three dimensions that make up sexual orientation, and it's important to understand this when we're thinking about sexual minority populations, such as women who have sex with women. The cognitive dimension is basically a sense of self, or how you self-identify, and you may identify as being homosexual, bisexual, heterosexual. Some people don't identify as anything or questioning. The affective dimension is basically the longing, fantasy, desires that you have towards other people. And then the third dimension is the behavioral dimension, which is basically the gender of your sexual partners. And it's important to note that these dimensions may or may not overlap for a given person, and they may fluctuate continuously during the lifespan for different people. And it's interesting to note, even in recent NHANES data, more than half of all respondents who reported having sex with another woman in their lifetime identified as heterosexual. So here's one example of differences and discrepancies in how you identify and your behavior with your sexual partners. So for the purposes of this talk today, I just wanted to review several sexual behavior definitions, because in this talk and in my own research, I mainly focus on the behavioral aspect of sexual orientation. And so WSW, we've already had that in the title today, that is women who have sex with women. And subdivided in this group of women, I'm going to mention exclusive women who have sex with women, which for this talk are women who have never had sex with a man in their lifetime. And also I've mentioned WSWMs, which are women who have sex with both women and men. And then we have women who have sex with men only, WSM populations. So just a brief overview of women who have sex with women. According to the most recent National Survey of Family Growth, approximately 12.5% of all American women aged 15 to 44 years reported a history of lifetime sexual contact with another woman. This group of women is traditionally less vocal and less visible than other members of the LGBT community, particularly MSM. They've traditionally been considered to be at low or no risk for sexually transmitted infections, including HIV, which I'll show you some data today that argues against this point and shows that these women are actually at risk for some of our STIs. And due to traditional lack of awareness with regards to their risk, there's few targeted HIV and STI services available for this group of women. So they have traditionally been a hidden population, which is currently evolving. In the past, only 18 to 49% of women who have sex with women and women who have sex with women and men have disclosed their sexual orientation to a healthcare provider. And some of the reasons cited in some of these studies are stigma, fear of homophobia, and past negative experiences in the healthcare setting. These women have been said to experience multiple barriers to accessing healthcare, which I have several listed here. Some report having less of a choice than MSM for finding an LGBT-friendly healthcare provider through their insurance plan. Others have issues with obtaining healthcare insurance in the absence of spousal benefits for same-sex couples with many of the insurance companies. And others may go unrecognized by healthcare providers who have little to very minimal education that they've been taught in medical school or residency throughout their training with regard to LGBT patients. Or just healthcare providers who only focus on heterosexual sex when they're talking to patients. And finally, more so on the patient side, women who have sex with women may not actually perceive themselves to be at risk for sexually transmitted infections. And because of that perception, they may not feel that they need to access healthcare to get tested. So as an example of what I just mentioned about healthcare providers and medical education, there was a very interesting landmark study published a couple years ago in JAMA that came out of Stanford University. And the investigators there surveyed all of the medical schools in the United States and Canada. And we had 121 United States medical schools that responded to this survey and 11 medical schools from Canada. And they found that during the preclinical medical education years, only a median of 4 hours in both countries were spent towards LGBT-related health education. The preclinical years are, for those of you that don't know, are when the medical students are in class for most of the time, the first 2 years, before they get out into the wards and into their rotations. For the clinical years, which are years 3 and 4, when they're actually seeing patients all the time, a median of only 2 hours were spent in United States medical schools and no hours in Canadian medical schools. So this was very interesting to make us realize that LGBT health education for our own students here in our own country has a long way to go. And as an example of what I said about women who have sex with women may not perceive themselves to be at risk for sexually transmitted infections, this is something that I've recently come in contact with in my own research studies in Birmingham, Alabama. I have two quotes here from some focus group discussions we did with some African-American women who have sex with women in our community. And this happened last year or so. And a common theme when we looked at the qualitative data in this study was that women were definitely more aware of their risk for STI acquisition from their male sexual partners than their female sexual partners. And I'll just read one of the quotes for you today. "It's a popular belief if you are a lesbian, you probably won't catch anything just for the simple fact that some lesbians do, but most don't. But if you're with a male, you're more likely to catch something." So just to now talk about the epidemiology of STIs among this group of women. Basically, our data comes from case reports, small prevalence studies, and surveys of self-reported STI history among women who have sex with women. A lot of that, which I have to acknowledge Dr. Marazzo, who will be here later to talk about bacterial vaginosis, she's done a lot of these studies in Seattle that we have available to look at in the literature. And she's found in a lot of her studies, and I'm finding in my own studies, that STI transmission among women who have sex with women depends on the STI under consideration and the sexual practices that are involved. And I have a couple of case reports cited here. There are several case reports mentioning specific female-to-female sexual transmission of certain STIs. There's a case report about metronidazole-resistant trichomonas infection that came out in 1996 that hypothesized that this was transferred between two women through mutual masturbation. There's also a case report of syphilis between two women, potentially through oral genital sex. And then there's a case report of genotype concordant HIV between two women that was published about 10 years ago in Clinical Infectious Disease. And this was, they hypothesized, or when they talked to the patients, they felt that this was due to vigorous sex toy use causing bloody secretions in the vaginal canal, and that HIV had been transmitted between these women that were engaging in this practice. To make this all more complicated is that a lot of these women also have a history of sex with men. In the majority of studies, about 80 to 90% of these women report a lifetime history of sex with men and continue to do so frequently throughout their lifespan. And as Dr. Geisler mentioned, and I've already mentioned, the majority of my research particularly focuses on African-American women who have sex with women. And this group of women has been said to face a triple jeopardy by virtue of their sex, sexual identity, and race. And there's some early data from the 1960s and 1970s of African-American WSW populations that suggests that they have even more heterosexual experiences than Caucasian WSW patients. And the rates of STIs among this group of women, especially those in the southern United States, where our STI rates are very high and there's a lot of health disparities in African-American populations, are not as well characterized as in other groups of WSW. So I wanted to briefly mention a few STIs that we see most commonly in women who have sex with women in my own studies and those of Dr. Marazzo and other investigators. The first is trichomoniasis, which I've already mentioned, the case report of female-to-female, suspected female-to-female sexual transmission. Early studies in the 1980s and early 1990s have reported a very low prevalence of trichomonas among this group of women. And I will say that in a lot of these studies, trichomonas was detected only using a wet mount of vaginal secretions, which I think they mentioned in the trichomonas debate yesterday. The sensitivity of this is very low. I think they mentioned 38% in one study yesterday. And the best that I've seen in any study is up to 70% sensitivity on a wet mount. In my own studies in Jackson, Mississippi and Birmingham, Alabama, of two different cohorts of African-American WSW, in each of these cities, I've found higher trichomonas rates in both locations, which I have listed here, 13 to 17% in exclusive WSWs during the past year, and then 24 to 25% in WSWMs over the past year. And so why do we wonder why these higher prevalence rates are going on? We have several explanations for this group of women. We did use trichomonas culture in both of these studies, which may have increased our sensitivity. I'd be interested to know, I think that the sensitivity is going to go up even higher when we use the trichomonas nucleic acid amplification test, because that is definitely more sensitive than wet prep and culture. We know that there's a higher prevalence of trichomonas in racial minority groups, particularly the African-American population, so I'm sure that this has something to do with it. And also, my women in these cohorts have reported to me more frequent sexual interactions with men than I've seen prior in literature of other populations of WSW. In addition, a lot of these women, up to 75%, do not have health care insurance and are probably not routinely accessing care or getting tested for this infection. So I had something interesting that happened in one of my research studies that I wanted to share with you today. I mentioned I had a cohort of women that we enrolled in Jackson, Mississippi, and we actually enrolled 196 African-American women who have sex with women in this study. And out of 196 women, we found three sexual partnerships in which both women had trichomonas infection. And so we're interested to see, can trichomonas truly be transmitted between women? The case report that I had mentioned to you before, they had hypothesized about mutual masturbation, but there's no study that had ever looked at genotype concordance between trichomonas isolates between women. And so we did the RAPID technique, which is random amplified polymorphic DNA technique in our laboratory using these isolates. And we found that one out of the three couples had the same trichomonas isolate. And so we're hypothesizing that this was sexually transmitted between these two women. And it was interesting when we really went back and looked at our behavioral data that we had collected from all of these women in the study and did a follow-up interview. These two women that had the same trichomonas isolate, the only sexual practice that they had really been engaging in with each other was they were using a washcloth to do mutual masturbation on each other, and they were wetting this washcloth to wipe their vaginal areas, and they were sharing this washcloth very frequently during their sexual activities. And so we were wondering, can a wet washcloth sort of be a fomite that's used during sexual activity that could help transmit trichomonas during female-to-female sex? And this took me all the way back to 1959, a long time ago, definitely before I was born, where they actually did a study about cultures of washcloths used to cleanse external genitalia of women infected with trichomonas. And so at the Columbia Hospital for Women in Washington, D.C., between 1954 and 1957, they enrolled 38 women who all had trichomonas. They all wiped their vaginas with a washcloth, and they waited different proportions of hours to culture secretions from these washcloths in their laboratory and see if trichomonas grew out. And as you can see here in this chart, trichomonas can definitely survive all the way up to 24 hours on a wet washcloth. So I thought this was interesting. The next STI I wanted to briefly mention is human papillomavirus. This has been seen fairly frequently in women who have sex with women. Transmission here requires only skin-to-skin or mucosal contact. HPV DNA has been detected from the cervix, vagina, and vulva in 13 to 30% of women who have sex with women. And in one study, HPV DNA was present in 19% of exclusive women who had never had sex with men in this study. In addition, high and low-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions have been detected on Pap tests in exclusive women who have sex with women with no lifetime history of sex with men. And this has led several investigators to recommend that women who have sex with women should receive cervical cancer screening in accordance with current guidelines. There's also a lot of literature out there about lesbian identifying women, and it's been shown across the board that these women think that they are at much less risk for acquiring cervical cancer than heterosexual women, and that a lot of these women don't believe that they actually even need to come to get pap smears for routine screening. Herpes simplex virus is also common in this group of women. A seroprevalence study of 392 WSWs found a 46% seroprevalence rate of HSV-1 and 8% of HSV-2. That was back in 2003. And it was interesting in this study that HSV-1 seroprevalence increased as the number of female sexual partners increased. And we know that oral genital sex is very frequently practiced between lesbian women. In this study, there were 78 exclusive women who have sex with women, and the HSV-2 seroprevalence was 3% in this group of women. More recently, there was some data on HSV-2 seroprevalence that was published in 2010 in Sexually Transmitted Diseases, and this reviewed the HSV-2 seroprevalence in NHANES from 2001 to 2006. And as I have listed here, there are some interesting differences between sexual identities and sexual behaviors in this study. Basically, women who identified as heterosexual that did not report a lifetime same-sex behavior, the prevalence of HSV-2 was 23.8%. However, women who were heterosexual that did report a lifetime history of same-sex behavior, the prevalence almost doubled twice, up to 45.6%. And then the bisexual identifying women with a report of lifetime same-sex behavior, the prevalence was 35.8%. With regards to bacterial STIs, including chlamydia and gonorrhea, these are considered much more uncommon among women who have sex with women. Early studies reported very low prevalences among these group of women. There was a study done recently about chlamydia positivity among women who have sex with women, young women who have sex with women, at family practice clinics in the northwestern U.S. I think there was about 10,000 patients in this study, and they found that the chlamydia rate for women reporting same-sex behavior was 7.1%, and the rate for WSM was 5.3%. And as you can see here, rates in our studies in African-American WSW and WSWM are particularly higher, especially in the WSWM population. So I'm running out of time, and Dr. Marazzo is going to talk to you about bacterial vaginosis, so I'm actually going to skip through this slide. But BV, I will just say real quick, BV is very common in women who have sex with women, perhaps more so than in WSM populations. And last thing I wanted to talk about, there's some interesting differences between exclusive WSWs and women who have sex with women as men. And as you can see probably already with some of the data that I presented today, WSW themselves are not a homogenous group. And there's some data that came out of the UK initially, the British National Survey of Attitudes and Lifestyles, that showed that WSWM were more likely to report greater numbers of male sex partners, anal intercourse, failure to use barrier protection, alcohol or drug use, and have an increased likelihood of abortion and STI diagnoses than women who have sex with men only. In addition, the 2006-2010 NSFG, the National Survey of Family Growth here in the United States, which compared lesbians to heterosexuals and young bisexual women, found that the bisexual women reported the earliest sexual debut, the highest number of male partners, greatest use of emergency contraception, and higher frequency of pregnancy termination. And just very quickly, in some of our own data from Birmingham, Alabama, we've currently enrolled 163 African-American women in our most recent studies. And out of this group of women, during the past year, WSWMs were significantly more likely to report sex with a new or casual sex partner right here, and sex with multiple partners at the same time compared to exclusive WSWs. And this translated into increased STI rates among this group of women in our own population, pretty much across the board. any curable STI, the WSWMs had 37% of them had one of these infections. And with regards to serological evidence of HSV2, our prevalence in this study is actually higher than that seen in a lot of the other studies I mentioned today, up to 64%. And this was significantly different between exclusive women who have sex with women. And the last thing I wanted to mention, we took a closer look at lifetime exclusive women who have sex with women and compared them to an age-matched group of African-American women who have sex with women and men in this study in Birmingham. We are looking at serological evidence of STIs in these two groups of women, and we found that WSWMs were significantly more likely to have serological evidence of chlamydia and HSV type 2. And in this study, WSWMs had twice as many STI diagnoses than exclusive WSWs. So currently we have the 2010 National STD Treatment Guidelines, and there's a section on WSW. And the recommendations are for to engage in comprehensive sexual history, including questions on identity and behaviors for all women, screen WSW for all STIs normally screened for in heterosexual women, HPV vaccine and cervical cancer screening should be offered in accordance with current guidelines for these women, even those who deny a lifetime history of sex with men. And we definitely want to encourage targeted healthy sexual practices between women who have sex with women, such as protective barrier method use. I was excited they put a female condom in our packets at this conference. Cleaning of sex toys between uses and not sharing washcloths. That's my own personal thing. All right, these are my acknowledgments. I just want to acknowledge my colleagues at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and my research team at the University of Mississippi, and also our colleagues at Louisiana State University Health Science Center. Thank you very much.